again, I'm Sego Segoli Ani, and welcome to Compelling Conversations. You're listening to CKRZ 100.3 FM, the voice of the Grand, coming to you from downtown Oswegan. And in the studio with me, I have Mr. Rick Hill. He is Tuscarora and Beaver Clan, and he is the former Senior Project Coordinator for the Indigenous Knowledge Center at Six Nations Polytechnic. And currently, if this is correct, Rick is the Indigenous Innovation Specialist for Mohawk College. And I understand also that Rick has been working on a book, and I'm not sure if that's completed. He's been working with some other historians. I'm not sure if that also ties in with the topic that we're going to be talking to Rick about today, which is Tom Hill. And as you may probably know, Tom Hill passed away on November 11th, and it was a sad loss for our community. But he leaves a huge legacy behind. Some fabulous, fabulous comments in just honor of him all over social media over the last week and since his passing. It's a pleasure to have Rick Hill with me here in the studio. So I just want to say Scano Sego and welcome.
Thank you. Yes, it's true. I work for Mohawk College, although I'm not quite sure what I do there, but I work very hard at it.
Now, I mentioned this book, Rick. Is this book that you're working on in association with Tom Hill? Was Tom involved with this at all?
Not involved, but kind of. The book I'm working on with other historians is The History of the Mohawk Institute. The Mohawk Institute became the Woodland Cultural Center, and it's there that I worked in the 70s and became later involved in doing work with Tom there. That's how I really got to know him. I mean, I've known Tom before in the art world,
right?
But it's there where we spend a lot of time talking, laughing, and conspiring on how do we make art, history, and culture a part of our daily lives.
Mm. Going back to those early days, what is your recollection of Tom and his impetus in terms of wanting to move that forward like that?
When I first got involved with Tom, he used to be the curator of the contemporary Native art collection at Indian Fairs, a job that I later got, 20 years after he had it. So I got to know him through there. At first, tell you the truth, I thought he was kind of aloof. Hmm. He just seemed different. It seemed like he lived in a different world because he had been hanging out in the higher echelons of the art world in Canada and just had a different sensibility about him. But once we got talking and all of a sudden realized, well, we're both artists, we're both named Hill, we're both on the chubby side, and we are able to bridge all of that to realize that we're working on the same thing. You can have very different points of view about art, about history, about culture, but you can still work together to help people understand the dynamics of that discussion. And so I always appreciated the fact that Tom, him and I could have some very friendly arguments about what do things mean, but never to the point of where we became enemies of each other. He was always interested in another point of view. If you could make that point, make it intelligently, make it compassionately, then, you know, that was part of the... So I learned a lot about art, about culture, about community from Tom. Ironically, all my adult life, people have mistaken me for him. Because, like I said, we're both about the same size. We both have very ample kissing lips. And so, because they had the same last name, so everywhere I'd go, he says, "Oh, Tom, how are you? Are you Tom Hill? Are you Tom?" Mm. So after a while, I got to say, "No, I'm Rick Hill." I said, "He's the smart one. I'm the good-looking one."
Well, you know, that leads me to another point that I was going to ask, and you kind of you've answered it, but not really, and that is you both have the last name Hill. So I was wondering if there was some kind of a family connection at all.
No, it's something that Tom always wished for. He wished we were related. But no, you know, as it is, there are many different Hill families here. But I actually, my Hill name comes from Tuscarora over in New York. My relatives over there moved over here back in the 1870s. Mm. But because of that commonality, I think Tom and I both had an attitude. I don't know where we got it, but where there's a hill, there's a way. And so we would work very hard at trying to achieve the things that we wanted to. It's just that he, because of his experience in working with the National Gallery and working on some major exhibitions and have a higher profile, he kind of had a broader sense of art than I did. So I appreciate he mentored me into that. As I spent a little bit more time kind of like down in the trenches with community artisans and people crafting, it was an interesting blend between the two, how it worked. we knew some of the same people and worked with them. So it was always, it was always invigorating to work with Tom Hill. Sometimes frustrating in that Tom had, he had high community standards. He had high expectations of you. And it was like he wanted to draw the best out of you. And sometimes that took some more time with others. But he always valued people. He valued them. Had him and I had kind of low tolerance for administrative bureaucracy and, the whole stumbling block institutions come up with. But we had to work on that together. I was a little bit more, maybe a little bit more vocal in my my consternation. Tom was a little bit more of a diplomat, so we made a good tag team, you know. Send in the one guy, and then when that's not working, send in the other guy. So we worked on a lot of projects together.
Tom is credited with, and his name comes up, of course, with Expo 67 Montreal. His name is associated with moving indigenous, as we call it, native art from artifacts to being art.
Yes, I think that was one of the main things I guess I was impressed with, was Thomas's broad experience in that, helping me take a look back at the things that we made, because it was always a dilemma. Is it art or is it craft? Is it artist or artisan? You know, how we approach that. But that important exhibit that he did to help elevate the ancestral work, looking at its visual qualities, it's kind of like the things that makes it transcend more than the object. Years later, Tom and I did an exhibition catalog for the National Museum of the American Indian. I had to fly all the way out to Banff because he was a kind of an artisan residence out there. We looked at these old things in the collection, and we compared our stories, and we both kind of wrote about favorite pieces. And I just thought that was just a very interesting way of work. Rather than have the curator as the all-important, all-knowing voice, the curator brings these diverse voices together and share that. And so we did this book, and it worked out fairly well. It was actually written up in the New York Times. And I kind of treasure the time that I had with Tom to work on it. But when you work with Tom, you know, half the time you spend laughing. He's got great stories, great jokes, you know, and he knew how to kind of poke fun at things without being mean. But so we went to the Buffalo Park in outside of Banff. We're driving around. Of course, we didn't see any buffaloes. And all of a sudden, the cars stop. And out comes this huge bull walking across the road, standing there right in the middle of the road. And I didn't notice this at first, but Tom says, look, he has an erection. And I said, oh. And then Tom said, Rick, I think he's winking at you. And he's standing there just long enough, so all the tourists out there taking a picture of him with his manliness, and then he walks off into the bush. So it was only Tom that I think could think that quickly about such things and to make me feel like, yeah, I think you're right. I think he was winking at me.
Okay. Now, if I remember correctly, in the post that you put out about Tom after his passing, I believe you referred to him as a true Haudenosaunee humanist, I think. Is that the terms or words you use?
Yes. Yeah, so in many ways, Tom was not a lofty academic. You know, he didn't write these long dissertations about art. But he brought the humanity out of the art, humanity about our culture, humanity about ourselves, which includes some humor. But he was a firm believer in that we are people, first of all, the Ongwe, the original people, and that we have to keep our humanity and not try to think that we're smarter than everybody else or we got this, you know, this great elevated intellect. He often said that some of the strongest things he learned were from his grandparents, from old people in the community, who were just out doing things old people did, you know, taking care of the farm or weaving baskets because they needed the baskets or whatever, gathering food. But he saw great, I don't want to say nobility, but he saw great strength in that kind of thing, people taking care of themselves, and he felt that's our strength. We had been disabled because of colonization, and Tom felt like if we can just reach in and draw from that strength that our ancestors had. If we could just make things again, that builds up our self-esteem, builds up our sense of pride, and it's a way in which we get to express ourselves. But there's also another element. You don't need to make it exactly like they did. You make it for you. So every generation defines for themselves what it means to be them. And that's why we can live the way we do today and not think that, oh, well, we're betraying tradition, but that we're carrying tradition forward in a new way. So I think I really was inspired by Tom's thinking about that.
Tom seems like he was a person very comfortable in almost any situation, whether it was, like you were saying, at the higher echelons, or as I heard from one person as they were spending some time in Vancouver, and Tom invited them out to dinner. They were walking down, around Hastings, East Hastings in Vancouver, and there was a street vendor, and they were serving up food and, for the homeless, and he went right over, and they ended up eating the same food and just indulging in that situation. And, it's not everybody that would do that or could do that.
Yeah, I think sometimes people who gain some notoriety, some success, they begin to put on airs about themselves and somehow feel like, I'm better than other people. Tom certainly earned his place, and he's got to be credited with being a real trailblazer, opening the doors for others to help create a social movement about art, culture, and history. But to me, at least by the time I met him, he always had this humility. Mm. I don't know it all. I don't think about it all. But here's what I know. And he's willing to share what he had. And a lot of times, the way he looked at things, it was quite inspiring. And so that's why we could have a feisty dialogue about a matter. Like in one sense, we kind of went round and round about medicine masks. Are they inherently sacred? Mm. Should they be sold at Erocrafts? Or what should be done with these things? And we sometimes we just had to go to neutral corners, okay? Mm. We know we don't believe in the same thing, but let's protect what's in the middle there. And we worked on that. Tom was also instrumental in getting the museums to begin to come up with policies and programs that were more to enhance our role as Indigenous people in these matters. So we've had in the museum field, the art field, the curator field, but there's also this home field. I really honor Tom for leaving all of that. He could have spent the rest of his life in the high towers of the academy or the art gallery. He came back home to do some work. And he took over the job at the Woodland Cultural Center, trying to give new and emerging artists their first exhibition and the chance, bringing new audiences to bear on that. And it was his, I don't want to say his pervasive personality that brought very different groups of people together. Mm. So I think, as I wrote, he's one of the few people I know that could have been comfortable in the high art gallery or in the lofty museum, in the corporate boardroom, but also in the longhouse and ceremonies and in singing with the old mush singers. I mean, he's able to travel all of that, as most of us can, really. Mm-hmm. We mm-hmm. live in many different worlds. Mm-hmm. But not to let those outside worlds so influence you that you feel uncomfortable in your own skin.
Right.
Tom was deeply rooted in this community. He really honored his family and their legacy, and he tried to do something to make sure that those things that they valued stay alive in our lives today.
Speaking of values and staying alive and those kind of things, one of the other comments that I heard about him was he put other people first. I mean, it's kind of like things that you're saying about him, in that he put his paintbrushes aside and started to encourage younger people and other people so that they could come forward and show what they had to offer.
Well, in many ways, Tom's life and mine parallel because of that same thing. I went to art school. I was going to be a painter and photographer, but we couldn't get our work shown in reputable places. So then I did the same thing. I kind of set aside my own art career to say, well, I'm going to help to create those spaces and do those things. Went on to build the Native American Center for the Living Arts in Niagara Falls, working at the Woodland Culture Center. I was the museum director at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, and I was a program director at the National Museum of the American Indian, always looking again at art and giving an opportunity for art. I didn't have to like all of the art that I presented, but the idea is, here's something people are doing, Indigenous people are doing. Let's take a look at that. Him and I sometimes would disagree on a curatorial voice over which paintings or sculptures were really good. He told me this story one time. The Inuit art section, so I think in Ottawa, there's the Native art section, Inuit art section. They both foster and collect work. Well, the Indian art section was really controlled by the marketplace. There was a certain style you had to do, certain things they wanted to see. Well, there's one Inuit artist who broke out of that, and he made this carving of Elvis Presley. If you can imagine, Inuit version of Elvis. It was actually really great. Well, wouldn't you know, they were actually destroying sculptures that didn't fit into the mold. The stuff would come in from these distant communities, get to Ottawa, they would try to market it or try to collect it, and Tom had to sneak in there and to rescue that piece. He knew they were about ready to destroy it. And I think that in itself, maybe I shouldn't be saying that because he probably violated a few federal laws in doing that, but who cares now? But that courage to stand by somebody who's trying something different, I think was also helpful for me to see. It wasn't about me promoting what I liked, but me taking a look at what people are doing and giving everybody a chance to present their art. I think that's important part of his legacy, and the Woodland Center is still doing that, and I think that's one of his attributes. In its annual art exhibit, you're going to see brand new artists with emerging artists with well-established artists, and Tom tried to break down that hierarchy, being, you know, once you've made it, you're too good to show with other people. He says, no, we're all ourselves, we're all of this community, we're all Haudenosaunee or whatever, we're all indigenous, so let's show our artwork together.
You know, that comment you just made about rescuing this piece of art, this Inuit art, makes me wonder about, you say he may have broken some laws, but is there no laws protecting people's art? I mean, how could they get away with destroying it?
Yeah, that's the power of the marketplace and of arts management. Mm. And in the old guard, the arts management system was very Caucasian-driven, defining what the art is, or what the standards are, what the value of it is for. So Tom and I, as well as many others, have tried to work to change that scenario. Yeah. And it's been successful. If you look at the price of contemporary Indigenous art today, that would have been unheard of 30 years ago, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. So Tom's impact is a ripple effect, and it plays out. So there's people, Indigenous artists today, who never met Tom, probably never read anything he wrote, but they're the beneficiaries of Tom being in the world.
Well, I was going to ask you if there was anything just to wrap up with and say about, you know, his legacy and how the impact of what he did and started to move forward with, you know, had an impact with, but you just basically summed it up there. Is there anything else you can think of, Rick?
No, it's just, you know, as I get older too, my friends falling away just seems like every loss, you know, I feel it so directly because they're part of what made me me. And so, on the other hand, as much as you hate to see these people pass away, I can live with the joy of knowing Tom. I knew Tom. We worked together. We did things together. We accomplished things together. We laughed together. And those are irrepressible memories. And I'd rather have that than have somebody have to suffer longly. He suffered enough during his life. So he's earned his just rewards, and I wish him well on his journey upward.
Okay, yeah, well, for that, and very much appreciate you coming in and sharing this.
So I'm glad to be here. Okay. So hopefully I'll send somebody when I pass away to tell you all of the good stories about me.
Nyawa to Rick Hill for coming in to talk about his life and association with the late Tom Vernon Hill, part two of our series honoring and celebrating Tom Hill's life. I want to thank him once again. We want to thank you for listening to Compelling Conversations right here on CKRZ 100.3 FM, the voice of the Grand. I'm your host, David Moses. Until next time, Ona and Bumapi.